Hello and welcome to an exciting new episode of Fire and Water Records, a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Ryan Daly, and if you're wondering what makes this episode so exciting, as if all of our shows aren't jaw-dropping thrill rides, this one is the kickoff of a new subset of episodes we'll be doing called No Skips, where my co-host and I, rather than select favorite songs from an artist's catalog, we review one particular album front to back. Leading off this new series is one of my all-time favorite records, one that has come up in conversation a lot on this show. From 1993, the year that launched Fire and Water Records in a way, it's Siamese Dream by Smashing Pumpkins. Joining me, as if there'd be any doubt, the melancholy to my infinite sadness, my brother, Neil Daly. What's up, Neil?
How's it going, bud? How's it going? That's much better. That's a much better intro for me than what I thought you were going to go with, is the Jimmy Chamberlain to my Billy Corgan. So.
Never.
Yeah. Hey, man, what's going on? It's strangely ironic and in a weird way bookends, you know, the first Fire and Water Records podcast we ever did was the year 1993. And in that, we talked about our favorite band and one of our favorite albums of all time, and then we never came back to the album.
we had planned it. Like, I was gonna say, like, isn't it safe to say we've been trying to do this episode, if not for the last 30 years, then certainly since we started the podcast?
Absolutely. Yeah. So it is fitting that this is that. I do think that this is perfect. I'm really excited about this new subset of episodes we're going to do, the no skips thing. And I think we have, you know, had plenty of private discussions about what would make a no skip album, and that would be a great idea for this. So this album kind of does hold a personal place in both of our hearts, and it's a good launching point for this new thing. I do want to put a little caveat out there for the listeners that this No Skips by no means constitutes a perfect album. I think we want to be careful about that, because there are very, very few and far between perfect albums. Mm-hmm. But this, however, comes close. And, you know, for lack of a better way of explaining it, it's an album that you can simply put on and play straight through start to finish without having to skip a certain track. So it's not perfect, but it's pretty damn close.
Right. I would say, like, a perfect album might be every song is an absolute winner, whereas this No Skips album is every song is worth a listen, and you're not going to take your time to skip that one, even if it's less strong. But we'll get into the nuances of that in a little bit. Other ideas of why we picked this one in particular to lead off. This is 1993, 2023. It's the 30th anniversary of the release of Siamese Dream, so we really wanted to do it this year. If you're listening to this episode when it drops on October 27th, Halloween is coming up, Smashing Pumpkins. There's a bit of a thematic tie in there. But the other thing, this new format that we're doing, it's not a pivot for Fire and Water Records. This isn't how we're going to do every episode going forward. For instance, the next episode that you hear after this one will probably be going back to our old thing of coming up with our favorite songs from a particular band, and you'll have to wait a little bit to find out what that one is. And then we're also going to continue to do some of our holiday-themed shows as they come up, and I would really love next year to get back to some soundtrack selections episode as well. But as Neil was mentioning, over the years that we've been doing this podcast, a familiar concept that kept popping up was this idea of either a no-skip album or a perfect album. And we're drawing this distinction. But that is an album that has no bad songs or a record that in the pre-digital age, you put on your player and you listen to the whole album from the first track to the last, not skipping any song along the way. Hence, no skips.
And I should also jump in there too, real quick, and just mention that, you know, in doing so, it would have been far easier to take albums from the 70s and 80s that had maybe 8, 9 songs, maybe 10 songs. It's much easier to get a perfect album with no filler when your track list is pretty shallow. So this is kind of a rarity that you've got a 13 song album that's considered no skip. So
yeah, when Born to Run is 30 minutes and this one is 65 minutes or something close to that. It's like, yeah, that's a lot. It's a lot harder to clear that hurdle the more you put into it. Yeah,
absolutely. Like I, you know, the first thing that came up on my list would have been Alvin and the Chipmunks, Chipmunk Punk, because that, that 25 minute album was pretty solid, pretty solid. I don't think I ever skipped over anything.
That's the law of large numbers. The more songs you put onto an album, the more likely one of them is going to be a dud, but no. Well, but other than Chipmunk Punk, just as a little bit of a preview or a tease for what might come up in future episodes, any other no skip albums you could think of?
Off the top of my head, yeah, there's a couple, and they surprisingly are a wide ranging swath of genres. Mm-hmm. I think we were talking about Rumours from Fleetwood Mac mm-hmm. being on that list. Mm-hmm. We had talked about, even believe it or not, a Taylor Swift album or two. Mm-hmm. There's a number of things that we've got in the pipeline that I think will be interesting to get some feedback from and get, you know, have discussions about.
The Stranger by Billy Joel, mm-hmm. Meatloaf's Bat Out of Hell.
That'll be fun.
Disintegration by The Cure. That's one that I can listen to without skipping any. And that's another one with quite a few longer songs. So that's a.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting too, to not kind of retread our previous steps, but there are certain albums that we've referenced in other podcasts that, you know, mm-hmm. like one could say Purple Rain, or one could say, or that the aforementioned Born to Run, you know, some of those are no skip albums. Yeah. So it'll be interesting as we go down this new subset. Like you said, this isn't the format going forward. This isn't the end all be all, but it's going to be interesting. It's an interesting, nice, welcome change of pace.
Yeah. So listeners, obviously the albums that we just mentioned, we'll be covering some of those in future episodes, probably bringing in other guests for different albums. And in the meantime, you know what? We would love to hear from you guys in the feedback or the comments section. If you have a particular favorite, whether you think it's a perfect album or a no skip album, let us know. But anyway, for now, for this one, we are starting with Siamese Dream. Neil, what is your Siamese Dream origin story? How and when did this record come into your life?
Boy, I think the Smashing Pumpkins were on my radar in terms of I've heard the name, because right around 91, they came to NIU as an opener for, I want to say, Pearl Jam and the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And that, in hindsight, would have been an amazing concert. And I skipped it. I skipped it. Didn't think there was anything of all that importance to it then. So anyway, but that name I'd heard. Then the next year, I end up in Los Angeles, and Los Angeles has one of the most famous alternative rock radio stations in the world, K-Rock. And that I started to get some exposure to certain songs off of Gish. I think Rhinoceros, believe it or not, was in heavy play on K-Rock. Then my first visual reference to the Smashing Pumpkins was the video for the song Today. Now, mm-hmm. Today was the second single, and we'll talk about this as we get into the tracks. Today was actually the second single, and I think K-Rock might have been playing Cherub Rock, but the video really didn't get any airplay, any traction from MTV. Today became a huge, huge video on MTV. It was one of those breakout videos that played, you know, almost hourly on MTV.
It was on Beavis and Butthead, which was the standard at the time.
Yep. And my reaction to the video was not that different than Beavis and Butthead's reaction to the video. I honestly can tell you, I remember seeing the video and wondering how many girls are in the band. that was my first reaction. You got the lead singer, Billy Corgan, who sounded like a female. Yeah, mm-hmm. In the song. And then you've got James, the guitar player, wearing a dress, and then Darcy. Like, I remember going, like, I have no idea. Are these even the people in the band? I was like, did they just cast actors? So I didn't know, but that was my first reaction visually to the band. And the song was a hit immediately, and I liked it, but it also was extremely overplayed. And then it was more or less when K-Rock picked up the rest of the album, and then I started to do a deep dive, listen to Cherub Rock, and that broke open my interest in the album. So I picked up the album and played it straight through and loved it, and that was my launching pad for them. And then I kind of retroactively went back and started doing, as we talk about, deeper dives into them. You know, I was kind of blown away by this. You know, at that point, right around 91, 92, I think we had talked about this previously, about we started to gain exposure to what were B-sides and outtakes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Pearl Jam had like an import album with two extra songs on it of the album 10 and stuff like that. And there was a couple of those things floating around. But K-Rock introduced me to this band, the Smashing Pumpkins, that they were playing like almost half a dozen B-sides at any given point. And I was like, how many songs did they record for this album? There was all kinds of stuff on the radio that wasn't getting play. And then they would later release B-side albums. And then, as we know, going forward, the Smashing Pumpkins probably record about another album's worth of material for every album that gets released, doesn't get released. So that going forward, but that was, you know, and I've got a whole lot more to say as we go, but that was kind of it for me. And then I'm pretty sure, if memory serves, like all music in your life, I probably turned you onto them from there.
Pretty much. And yeah, it was, so I was like maybe 6 months behind you in a lot of these things, like music coming to them, whether it was like from MTV or not. But like, you would send me, when you were in California, you would send me these mixtapes of the Lollapalooza mixtape volume one, which was an assortment of rotating songs from Pearl Jam, Nirvana, Red Hot Chili Peppers, and Jane's Addiction. And I would go through those, and of those, it was mostly the Pearl Jam songs that jumped out at me the most. And that's Pearl Jam became my favorite band for a little while. And then a year later, you're sending me Lollapalooza Volume 2, which is the Smashing Pumpkins, Green Day, The Breeders, and Stone Temple Pilots. And I'm coming through these. And, you know, and I'll be honest, at first it was Green Day that was hooking me, because their songs were shorter. They were a little bit poppier. They were just kind of like punk, and they had these like hooks. And the Pumpkins, I can just like, they didn't sound like anything else. Like, while I could put the others kind of like in that category, they sounded a little bit like these outliers that were just more complicated, more challenging. I didn't have the verbiage, maybe I still don't, to really kind of describe what it was that set them apart. But I remember like going for it, and I was like, this doesn't sound like a grunge band. Like, I could tell the Nirvana, the Pearl Jam, the Soundgarden, the Alice in Chains, that Seattle sound. There was something of a piece about those. And then when I listened to a Smashing Pumpkins song, I was like, I don't think this is the same thing. This is much weirder. And it would take me like a whole other generation before I kind of understood the psychedelic prog rock influences and the kind of like shoegaze idea of this music, because I hadn't been exposed to that yet. It was through that, but it was, at some point it clicked. And just listening to some of those songs, and on those, you know, cassettes you were sending me, there might have been six Smashing Pumpkins songs or seven or something like that. Right. And I think they were all from Cherub Rock, I think, or maybe one was from like Gish or something. But I do want to know more about those. And by that point, I think you would come back and you got Pisces Iscariot, the B-side album, at the midnight sale.
Right.
And you made me a mix that was songs from all of the first three, from Gish, Siamese Dream, and Pisces. And I kind of put those together. So I was listening to the songs from this album out of order, out of sequence. But eventually they kind of did hit me in this way that converted me. And I just had this overwhelming sense that these songs were strangely melodic and really catchy, but the structure was hard to identify. It didn't feel like I was listening to a verse, chorus, verse song.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I couldn't tell, honestly, like on the first listen, I couldn't tell you what part was the chorus, because he never repeated the same phrase in the chorus. Or like, what was a pre-chorus? What was a bridge? I still look at these songs and I'm like, all right, I think this is this part, but it's like, but, and yet it's still like, it's not atonal. It's not like discordant. It doesn't make me want to reject it. It still sucks me in. And there's just something about Billy as a songwriter and as a melody crafter that just, I don't know how he does it. It's this magic thing that it's catchy without being pop. And I'll get into that idea a little bit more later on. But yeah, eventually I would say, okay, there's enough here that I had to have all of these albums individually, and I would buy them all individually. And then just through listening to this album just again and again, it's like, there is not a bad beat on this one. Yeah. So
yeah, and more to that point too, what's funny is I picked up on all those same things. Like I was one of the first people I knew that kind of refused to call them a grunge band, and they were labeled it. First of all, alternative music, alternative rock at that time painted everybody into the grunge corner.
Yes,
and it just became like an umbrella term. And I was the first to kind of like reject that for the Pumpkins. I was like, there's nothing about them that sounds grunge. They don't have that, you know, that like influenced by Neil Young kind of, you know, thing that the Seattle guys all seem to have. I do remember too, what was interesting was my affection for the band went from 0 to 60 pretty quickly once I got into like that Cherub Rock. Then I picked up the album, then listened to it, because in that album came out summer of 93, and then Pisces Iscariot came out summer of 94. Fall of 94, because I had just come back home when we went to Downtown Discs or whatever it was. So within that 1 year, all of a sudden I was obsessed with this band and had to know everything about them and had to absorb as much as I could. And there were not enough B-sides out there for me to satiate my taste and stuff. Going back to what you were saying, I do want to touch, and again, we'll kind of go into this when we talk about the individual tracks and stuff, but I think what you were kind of getting at, if I could put it in my terms, about how their complicated structures of songwriting and stuff there, I kind of got a sense that like Billy Corgan, for those, you know, we'll talk about him. He's like a mad genius. And there was like a Willy Wonka machine of songwriting that he did. And I always kind of got the impression that he was smarter than everybody else in the room and knew how to, at the same time, show off how ambitious and creative he was, but still make it accessible. And that was a really interesting thing. Like you said, you know, there were songs that, you know, if you take, as we go through this album, we'll talk about Silverfuck or we'll talk about Geek USA. And these songs have breakdowns in instrumental portions, or Hummer has a completely 2-minute outro that has nothing to do with the rest of the song sonically. And like, there's things that kind of don't go together. It's a weird mishmash of songwriting and composition that is so different than anything I'd ever heard before. Not to mention sonically, how different it was. You know, I'm talking just about the compositions of the songs, and you could have a 6-minute song that maybe didn't even have that many lyrics to it. There was a lot of parts that are instrumental and things like that, but I just found it fascinating, and that sucked me in. And then on top of that, you could take a song, which we'll get into later when we talk about Mayonnaise. A song sonically is heavy and has huge distorted guitar riffs, but is one of the most beautifully crafted melodies you'll hear on a rock record. So, you know, there's just this weird, like I said, it's like a Willy Wonka machine creating, you know, the everlasting gobstopper. And then as we go forward, you know, I'll talk more about the sonics of the sound and what they chose to do and et cetera. We've got a lot to talk about. So
I want to be careful in the way I say this, because I don't want it to sound disparaging or belittling or anything. But like, when I think about those grunge bands of that time, of that early Seattle sound, a lot of the music and the guitar driven, the riffs and everything, a lot of it was very familiar, and to call it interchangeable is selling it way short, and I don't mean that, but it did seem like it was very kind of the same house style. And what set the bands apart in a lot of ways was the vocals, the vocal performance of an Eddie Vedder or Layne Staley or Chris Cornell or Kurt Cobain, and what they brought to it was kind of the measure of how different the band was.
True.
Contrast that with Smashing Pumpkins, where I don't want to belittle Billy Corgan's vocals or anything like that, but I think his vocals are often secondary to just this overwhelming sense of sound and driving guitar, matched equally with often the driving drums of Jimmy. And I can't say enough about what I think, if anything turned me onto this band, it's probably equally Jimmy Chamberlain's drums.
Sure.
More as much as Billy's guitars and vocals. And I don't know if I've ever said that about another band, that the drumming is what attracted me to it. But yeah, I'll get into that a lot.
Yeah,
And just going back, like the Pumpkins' first album with their first song on their first track, "I Am One." The drums that open that and just begin that song, I think are sort of captured my imagination in a way that they've still never let go of 30 years later.
Yeah, well, I think the proof is in the pudding on that when you talk about, you know, when at various points in the life of the Smashing Pumpkins, Jimmy Chamberlain has been out of the band and they have noticeably been less successful. It's very, very telling that.
And in fact, the immediate response when he had to leave the band because of his drug problems, they replaced him with drummers for the tour, but for the next album they recorded, they didn't replace him as a drummer. They just used drum tracks and drum machines and other things. So, yeah, I think that is important.
Yeah, for as ridiculously talented as Billy Corgan is as a guitarist, as a singer, as a lyricist, as a composition writer, all that stuff, he repeatedly says Jimmy Chamberlain is the best musician in the band, and I think that kind of sums it up. That kind of sums it all up. Lastly, what you were saying about this inevitable comparison to the other bands from that early 90s era, you know, I think, and this is in no way, shape, or form meant to diminish the talents of all these other bands. So like you, I'm going to be careful how I say this, but I feel like as a beginning guitar player, I found I could pick up and play Nirvana's album Nevermind pretty much straight through. And I could I could play Green Day, you know, every song on every album and that type of thing. So again, I'm not knocking those guys, but then, you know, I got the songbook for Siamese Dream, which I'll talk about later on. And that was just like reading a foreign language. I'm going, okay, there's a whole lot more going on right now. I'm not ready for this.
Yeah. So just some facts about the band, about the album that we'll get to before we go through the album track by track. We've mentioned a couple of names, but also the band Smashing Pumpkins, as it existed at the time, these are the founding members: Billy Corgan on vocals and guitar, James Iha on guitar, also some backup vocals, Darcy Retzky, she was the bassist and did some backup vocals, and Jimmy Chamberlain on drums. The album was produced by Butch Vig and Billy Corgan. Alan Mulder mixed the album. He was their engineer, and apparently it was supposed to take 2 weeks, but he took 36 days. So, yeah. He was contracted for just 14 days, and it took 36 days to mix the whole thing. They recorded it in Triclops Studios in Georgia between December 1992 and March 1993, and it was eventually released July 27th, 1993. It debuted at number 10 on Billboard's 200 list and spent 91 weeks on the charts, and eventually became quadruple platinum. So,
yeah,
quite a few units sold.
Yep. I want to say, boy, I mean, part of me thinks maybe it's, I want to say like it's over like 6 million copies now or something like that. Yeah. In terms of going a little bit deeper into the statistics and stuff like that, I think it's funny. You should mention the Pumpkins, their breakout album, Gish, or their first album, I should say, Siamese Dream was more of a breakout.
Right.
Gish was their initial release, and Gish was released on a Sub Pop label. That was a division of Carolyn Records was a Sub Pop label of the indie arm of Virgin Records. And when that album was released, they didn't think that they were good enough to get major label exposure yet. And that album became what is, I believe it still might be, the highest selling indie release of all time. I believe it is. I don't know if it was initially when it first came out, but it certainly over time has. So then they decided, okay, well, they got to do their sophomore album, and they were going to go on a major label. And then Nirvana and Pearl Jam broke out and became huge. So this placed inordinate pressure on the band then to make what would be the follow-up.
Yeah, we'll come back to some of the stories about the recording probably as we go through, but let's actually get to the tracks and start where we start, the beginning and the opening track, their first single, the song Cherub Rock.
Let me out.
opening drum roll for this song, like even though it takes a little while to get into the meat of the song, that opening drum roll feels like a marching band. It feels like a processional. Mm-hmm. There's this annunciation that something big is starting. We're going somewhere. We're going to be, you know, you got to catch a ride, follow along with us. We're going to take you somewhere. And it's just from there, you know, the guitars come in and it's like one piece at a time, the drums, a guitar, uh-huh. another guitar, the bass, another guitar. And we just keep on building and building until they finally hit that, like the real riff of the song, and it kicks off. What a great way to just start the album. What do you think of Cherub Rock?
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. I think it's funny that you mentioned this is their first two albums, you know, for a band that's mm-hmm. known specifically for Billy Corgan. Both albums open with the drum. You know, yeah. I think that's really, really interesting that happens. This song I think is really cool. Billy Corgan used this technique on Gish in a few songs. This particular song kind of introduced the world to what he calls the pumpkin chord, which is essentially you're playing a drone note like the low E string and then octaves of it halfway up the neck on like the 12th fret. And it's hard to explain audibly for those that have never played the guitar, but the main guitar riff, the dunna 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 dunna, that's a low, it's just an E chord, and he's playing a higher variation octave of it. And he does this repeatedly throughout this album. He did it in a bunch of songs on Gish, and he did it going forward. So it became like it introduced me as a guitar player and the rest of the world to what the pumpkin chord is. And I thought it's cool. It's something he actually stole from Jimi Hendrix, but he kind of made it identifiable. This riff was cool. When I heard it, I remember, and again, going back to what I mentioned in the beginning, there was something about this song that attracted me more than the song Today. And what this song had was, and it's great as an album opener because it introduces you to the sound of the album. And mm-hmm. It really is this, you know, I'd heard Billy say in multiple interviews before and stuff that you like when they were first starting out, you know, they would play in bars and nobody really cared who they were and people didn't listen and they were all talking and you hear beer bottles clanking and stuff. So he just said, let's just play louder than everybody else in the room. Like, let's play louder so they have to hear us. And so Gish had a lot of that. There's a lot of energy and a lot of loud guitars, but it's a different sound than this. Mm-hmm. There's something interesting and identifiable that when Cherub Rock starts, you hear what this whole album is going to sound like. And it was unlike anything sonically that I'd heard before. The guitars are completely different than anything Pearl Jam did, anything Nirvana did, anything Green Day did. It's just a whole different layering of distortion and fuzz and melody and all this stuff. I thought it was great. And the guitar solo was actually, I think Guitar Magazine ranked it, this guitar solo, as one of the top 100 guitar solos of all time. Like, it's in the 60s or something of all time. So yeah. I thought that was really cool. Lyrically, the only other thing I would add about this is it's also really, really interesting and very ballsy for a lead singer on their major record label debut to come out and make fun of the record industry. that's you got some cojones there, buddy, to come out and basically insult the industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I later on, as we get a little bit deeper into the album, I'll talk a little bit about, I got a kind of like a thesis about pop songwriting versus alternative songwriting, especially in lyrically. But that was definitely at the forefront of my attention during this era when I started thinking about bands like Pearl Jam and Smashing Pumpkins and these things, and like the way Billy or Eddie Vedder or somebody wrote a song and what how the lyrics were different from the lyrics that I was used to hearing on the radio, you know, a decade before that and everything like that. And it was just like there was something more introspective that it was a little bit more challenging. And I'll be honest, like, again, like listening to a Smashing Pumpkins, I'm Billy will give you a flood of imagery and catchy lines and stuff, but you have to work a little bit harder to piece together, okay, exactly what is he actually saying in the song?
Uh-huh.
This one, I think, was the first, this may be the only Pumpkin song where, like, I got it on first listen.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, he's obviously talking about conformity and resisting and the pressures of the music industry and what it means to be popular versus being independent, both musically and socially. Like, this, what are you in this industry for? What are you in this game for?
Yeah.
So even as a kid, I think listening to this song for the first time, I kind of like, I got it. I cracked this song, the code, on the first listen. And maybe just because, like, from, like, the opening lyrics, which are, like, some of my favorites, like, freak out, give in, doesn't matter what you believe in, stay cool and be somebody's fool this year. I was just, oh, that's just really cool turns of phrase.
Yeah.
And then, as you were saying, also, my favorite part of the song is 3 minutes and 8 seconds into the song, it's the beginning of the guitar solo. It's just like everything kind of builds and builds and builds, and then Jimmy has this little drum fill, and then the solo kicks in, and you're already 3 minutes in, and it just, like, feels like now he's just taking us for this, more of this ride. And you're like this again, a little microcosm of everything that's in the album, but just like where we're going, just like this driving energy. And it's like, as an opening salvo, it's like, wow, this is, but, like, where do you go from here? How do you top this? It's like,
It's funny too. You mentioned a little bit about the Billy Corgan's vocals, and I think it's interesting that this was still at a time where I think he was maybe a little bit insecure about his vocals, and I mean his singing voice, not the lyrics, but his singing voice, because in this song, the lyrics are kind of merged in the mix with the guitars and with everything a little bit more. As he goes forward, like say Bullet with Butterfly Wings in the next album, they become more out front. The vocals become more out in front of the music, whereas this was all part of the mix. Not in a bad way, not in a bad way at all. It's interesting that I really had to kind of like, okay, like, kind of tune in and listen with headphones and be like, okay, because he has this dreamy, soft way of singing in heavy distorted guitar parts, and then he'll burst out into like a banshee yowl and stuff. So it was, yeah, it was a neat contrast with the lyrics there. And this became a Pumpkins theme, qu quiet versus loud choruses. And that kind of thing became a neat juxtaposition that he used to great effect on this album.
Yeah, and I actually think that's a perfect segue to, because I had the same notes for the second song on the album, which is Quiet. Yeah, the first thing that I kind of think about with this one is, like, it feels like Billy seems to be singing in a softer voice than usual, which makes it sound like the heavily overdubbed guitars are drowning out the vocals. You do have to lean in and strain a little bit more to hear the vocals clearly, because in comparison, they're so quiet to this just thrumming rock music that just keeps coming. And this one, I'll definitely say, like, this one reminds me of, like, the hard-hitting rockers on Gish, like I Am One, Shiva, and Bury Me. I will say I like all of those songs better than this one. I don't have any complaints about it. Obviously, it's no skips. Like, I would never skip this one. Like, I don't have any complaints about this song, but this one never hit me as much as some of the other songs on this album. So it'd be a little bit lower in my ranking, but it's also just because of its placement, like right at number two as the follow-up to Cherub Rock. It feels like it's not a step down. It just feels like we're picking up and we're still running with it, and we're still, like, this hard charging energy that is really, really strong and really powerful to drive the album forward.
I think I like it more than you, which is fine. I think it's a great 1-2 punch, and it comes in with this like another thundering opening drum part that follows up right after Cherub Rock just cuts off and ends. Then all of a sudden you've got this, and then it comes in with this ascending guitar riff, which has the same type of distorted the Big Muff effects pedal that he used that he used pretty much throughout the album. I thought this was really cool. Now I'm going to veer off topic for a second, and just mention something that I was going to come back to eventually, and I didn't know where it would fall in this conversation, but Quiet was a song that was written in the second half of writing sessions for this album. And Billy talked on his 33 podcast, which came out last year, where he basically did 33 songs of their rock opera. But he would always take a single song from a previous album and kind of talk about that for a few minutes. So it was really neat, like a storyteller's kind of thing. And one of the things I did not know that I just learned was in recording this album, and again, this has to do a lot with the pressures of trying to follow up Nevermind and follow up 10. Billy had a handful of songs written, about over half of the album for Siamese Dream written. And Butch Vig came up to record with him. And Billy played a bunch of the beginnings of the songs for Butch in the car as they would drive around Chicago. And then Billy kept skipping and said, no, I don't like it. I don't like it. Let's listen to the next one. And he kept skipping ahead to Butch finally stopped him and said, hey, you're not ready to do this yet. Like, you're, what's going on? Like, these songs, I think they're fine, but you don't seem to be ready. And Billy was like, no, I need to do some more writing. So then Billy went back to the drawing board and wrote the songs Quiet, Today, Disarm, Mayonnaise, and Hummer, all separate from the initial writing sessions of the album, which we will talk at great length about how great those songs are. So this burst of inspiration that he got came almost after the fact, when he wasn't ready to put together the album that Butch wanted him to do. So now let's come really quick back to this song, to Quiet. This song also thematically kind of mirrors a lot of these later songs that he wrote about, or that I mentioned before, which we'll get into lyrics as we go. But this is, believe it or not, it's kind of one of the many suicide type songs on the album. And Billy has openly talked about the during this period of recording, with you've got a drummer that's addicted to heroin and disappearing for days on end. You've got two other members of the band who just broke up and ended a romantic relationship. So there's tension there. And then them not wanting to come in and record and fighting and stuff. So Billy doesn't feel like he's got the rest of the band with him. So he's re-recording all their parts because he didn't find them up to the level that he needed them to be at. And that was also encouraged by Butch Vig and echoed by Butch. He said, Billy, these other guys don't sound like the demos you sent me. Why don't you just do it all? So Billy then did it. And that caused friction in the band, which we'll talk about again later and stuff like that. But all this also Billy having a nervous breakdown and contemplating suicide. And there's another more prominent song that we'll get to where he talks about that decision to either shit or get off the pot, so to speak. But this song was one of the many where you can hear in the lyrics that thematically he's talking about trying to desperately kind of find your voice and speak out rather than just bury everything deep down inside that's going to eventually kill you. And that's why the song resonates with me on a powerful level when you strip it down and listen to the lyrics. That's what I take from it.
You hear those terms like a lot of times, like in movie making, like art from adversity and all of the happy accidents and the things that come when everything is going wrong. And sometimes that creates some of the most beautiful and most profound art. And again, just looking at where these musicians were at their life, you know, a lead singer, lead guitarist, the songwriter, the front man of the band wants to kill himself.
Yeah.
The drummer maybe doesn't want to commit suicide, but everybody in the band thinks he's going to die at any second because of his heroin addiction. Mm-hmm. And then the other two members broke up and hate each other and can't be in the same room together. And it's like, sure, let's throw all those pieces together and we'll make an album together. It's like, yeah, absolutely. That'll work. And we'll come back to some of the details too, again, like with Jimmy's and what Billy had to do to get him to just finish the album too.
Yeah, but it's also worth, you know, without glossing over this too much, I mean, at this particular point, Billy has said specifically that with James and Darcy's role in the band, he said, I gave you guys a year and a half to prepare for this record, to get up, to get your chops up to where I need them to be. And he said, and multiple times he said they weren't there. They didn't take it seriously enough. They didn't practice. They weren't as good as I needed them to be. So I played everything.
Yeah,
and that ended up causing, you know, that led to multiple multiple almost breakups and breakups of the band going forward and stuff. And Billy has said, you know, he almost says it kind of unapologetically that he's like, you know, playing, you know, where they're at playing now is totally different. James is a great guitar player now and Billy's happy with him, and playing live is different, but in the studio, if they weren't there, and Billy said otherwise, you know, other people might have said, they might have coasted on the success of Gish and said, okay, cool. Well, this is good enough. And Billy just wasn't like that. He's got that kind of Chicago Michael Jordan type of competitiveness to him, which you don't usually find in music. You know, this era was kind of marked by slackers and, you know, that kind of like, oh, we don't care. That's the Gen X thing. And Billy was like, no, I want to be the best band in the world. I want to bury Nevermind and 10 and be better than them, which is so anti early 90s. You're not supposed to have ambition.
It's even curious that in the liner notes, like, James is given the songwriting credit on Soma and Mayonnaise, and even kind of curious to think that Billy would have allowed that. But my favorite lyric on this one is the very last lyrics of the song. It's when he says, "Come save me from the awful sound of nothing." Just because I remember in the live performances, he screamed the last part, "Come save me from the awful sound," and then screamed "of nothing," like when like the band drops out and it's just him screaming that.
Yeah, that was cool in live iterations, especially because then you'd hear this like this echo of like, depending on what kind of hall they were playing in or what kind of amphitheater, you just hear that, like that after he cut the note off of nothing, it would still reverberate in the room. Powerful stuff. And again, it's again, speaking of contradictions, because that's what he likes to do. A song called Quiet is one of the loudest songs on the album.
Of course. All right. Next up, track three, the one that almost I'm sure everybody has heard, Today. I mean, I saw the video for this a lot. It was played so much. And I always thought the song was catchy and it was fun, but I concede that over time, it did get overplayed and overexposed. I think this is funny. It's kind of Billy's Born in the USA, in that this is the song that most people have heard, but they don't understand.
Very much so. Good comparison.
Yeah, because everybody hears the line, today is the greatest day that's ever I've ever known. This is a happy song.
It's puppy dogs and rainbows.
Exactly. You'd never know that this is about, it's a suicide song. It's quite the opposite. And so like, you hear like the chorus is "Can't live for tomorrow. Tomorrow's much too long." And then the second chorus, "Can't live for tomorrow. I might not have that long." When you think about the chorus, it's like, those do have a little bit more of a darker context.
Yeah. Well, then the other lyric that jumped out at me was, you know, he referenced pink ribbon scars that never forget.
My favorite line. I had that written down. Yeah.
But he talked about that was the mark of slitting your wrist and that kind of thing. And it's like, then like you suddenly get like all of a sudden these images, like once you understand it, you read it back and you're like, if I didn't hear music to that and read that, I'd be like, oh my God, that's the most depressing note I've ever heard. You know, it's fascinating. And, you know, and certain lines that I just love, the poetry of a line like "bored by the chore of saving face," you know, I'm like I've never heard it put that way, but everybody can you know, feel that, like we've all been there, that kind of, you know, that not having a voice, not you know, wondering what is it all worth, why are we doing this and stuff. Yeah, so, you know, I already talked about it a lot with the previous song, so I'm not going to get too much into it. But as I mentioned, this was the song that Billy Corgan says changed his, you know, saved his life. And he said that he was in a parking garage in Chicago, right outside their rehearsal studio place. And he wrote this song and "Disarm" back to back the same night. And this song was him saying, "I am so sick of fantasizing about my own death. It's like, oh my God, either fucking do it or get over it and move on. And he said that it was at that point, he just said, all right, I guess I'm a coward. I guess I'm a chicken shit because I'm too afraid to do it. And so I'm not going to waste any more time wishing it. He's like, I'm over it. I'm done. And this song came out, and it's powerful. It's in a weird way. I guess it is life affirming because it did save his life, but people do misconstrue it entirely. But it's, for whatever reason, this, that's awesome. You know,
I will admit, on a selfish level, my favorite part of the song is actually the guitar intro, the single notes intro, mm-hmm. because that was the one thing that I could learn to play on the guitar when I first tried to play the guitar. Actually, when we went to Dublin, we went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Dublin, and I could actually like go into a studio, hold a guitar, and like play. And there were like three things I tried to play, and one of those was the intro to Today, because I could still remember those notes.
That's awesome. That's funny. Speaking of that, you'll get a kick out of this. So the one thing, this was right around the time that I first discovered like tuning down the guitar to like all flat notes. So it was one half step lower than standard E tuning. And this song was tuned down. It was all E flat, which means that you needed one more fret lower than the guitar could go. So when I picked the guitar up to play this, I could play the single notes, which in a normally standard tuned guitar, they would start at the 12th fret, which is exactly one octave higher than the bass note. But this was on the 11th fret. So I could play it, doo, 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 and all that stuff. And I loved it. And I learned that and I got really good at it. But then when I dropped down to play the traditional chords for the chorus, it was out of tune. And it drove me nuts. And I couldn't figure it out until I got a songbook. And it was like, oh, the whole guitar is tuned down. Oh, okay. So he's actually just playing traditional like E, D, A, blah, 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 like all that stuff. It's just tuned. It's just tuned down. I was like, that bastard.
All right, from there we go to track number 4, Hummer. How do you even begin to describe this song?
I don't know. I really don't know. Okay, let me jump in. First of all, this is another song that references the pumpkin chord that I talked about before. It's that octave, which is the octave of the E that he's playing. And it's a two-finger chord. There is so much interesting stuff about this from the recording of it, like the intro, which they don't do live. But the intro to the song is like a reverse tape, like he played like a weird guitar thing on like a sitar and then reversed the tape and just had it come into the song. I don't know. It's not a fast paced song. You know, it's not plodding. It's just like it's kind of a mid tempo, heavy rock, shoegazy type of song. Yeah, I don't know where else to go with that. I'm curious to know your take about it, because most people do kind of consider this one of their favorites. It does strike a chord with people. The lyrics to this, again, keeping in mind that this was written at that second batch of writing for this, which was after he's not going to commit suicide. He knows he needs new songs for the album, and he's going to make this a masterpiece. So that's kind of his ambition. And so lyrically, this song kind of does take it's a constant recurring theme on the album about, you know, making this decision to live out loud rather than die quietly, as I say. And then the one, you know, there's so many good lines in this, like when you decide that your life is a prize, renew, revive, like those. Yeah. It's like, oh, my God, that's awesome.
This song is like amorphous and it's constantly changing. Mm-hmm. It's like jumping from hook to hook. Mm-hmm. There are like, I think eight vocal stanzas. And again, I keep using that phrase, or I use that phrase because I keep coming back to this idea that it's hard for me to identify like a verse or a chorus from song to song with these. But even like the stanzas that fall on the verse or the melody or the verse melody or a chorus melody, the vocal melody changes significantly each time. It's like it doesn't always match where the music is going underneath it. And how do you do that? How do you have like this chorus melody, but your vocals don't sound the same each time? And it's like not even like the lyrics, but like the inflections and the tone. And it's like, again, I think like he there's five different hooks throughout the song that it just keeps like changing and leaping from one to the one. It's like an anti-pop song that like does everything wrong and yet phenomenally, remarkably catchy,
Yes.
driven by, of all things, like, and everything that we've talked about, driven by, I think, his vocal melody,
Yeah.
which again
Yeah.
has no regular or repeated chorus, but something about like just like if you strip away the words, just like the sound of his voice and the melody and the inflections that he's giving into this kind of carries you through all of these changing waves of different music and like storm tossed, and it's beautiful. And then yeah, as you mentioned, like at the beginning of it, this culminates in a 2-minute outro. That doesn't sound like it's of a piece with a song, and yet it's its own beautiful part of it.
It really.
It's a phenomenal song, but it's just like what, like still 30 years later, I listen to this, I'm like, I don't understand how this works. I don't understand what he's doing, but it's, boy, it gets in your ear like an ear, like any infectious earworm song, and I want to listen to it again and again and again.
Yeah, I think you summed that up kind of perfectly in the sense that this defies all conventional pop trappings. Like everything that makes a, like if somebody was teaching a class on writing a pop song, this song would be the example of what not to do. And yet it is one of the most pops songs on the album. Like it is somehow, it's like, how can you take everything that you're not supposed to do? I mean, it easily sounds like these were like maybe five different parts of songs that he was working on and had no place for them, so he just strung them together. And then it was like, all right, let's just throw these together and see what happens. And it's phenomenal. And yeah, like you said, there's something like I think up to this point in the album, because this is track four now. Up to this point in the album, I don't think his lyrics and his vocals took over until this song. At this song, and it's mostly the part that comes out of the guitar chord, out of the guitar solo. There's like a whole different anti-bridge that comes out where he starts screaming about how I want something new. And what am I supposed to do with that? That part of the song is when all of a sudden the like he became a singer to me. Like that's the first, like the vocal leads this track.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like he's like a Dr. Frankenstein, except somehow the monster he put together is like beautiful. Like it doesn't look like a monster. It's just, it's like, yeah. Oh, it's the weirdest thing. Like listeners, when we get to the end of the album, we're actually going to do a little bit of a ranking of our favorite songs on this. And I'll just tell you, like, on any given day or any given week, this might be my number one. And that's because my top four songs on this album change from like day to day, if not minute to minute.
I have the same problem. I have the exact same problem.
So if this ended up being my fourth favorite song on the album, it's like, well, ask me again tomorrow. It's like, okay, but we're gonna move on to another one that I really, really love. We are now at track five, which was the last single that they recorded or that they released for the album. The song is Rocket. I can say that this was not the first Smashing Pumpkins song I heard, obviously. I think based on the tapes that you gave me, I think Cherub Rock was the first one I heard.
Probably.
But this was the first song that really knocked me back and really resonated with me. And I think it was because this one somehow bridges everything that's kind of good and distinctive and unique about the Pumpkins and what we've been saying about the music so far, but also marries it with a pretty catchy and pop hook. I don't know if it's like the most standard, but like this is kind of like a almost kind of the closest to a normal rock song on the album, I would think.
Sure, sure.
And maybe it was just because that was like the most accessible, the easiest to get into for a novice or a newbie like me. Mm-hmm. So I think because of that, this one was the lure. This one was the one that kind of that hooked me early on and was like,
oh, cool.
I like this. I like this a lot. I want to hear more of this. So this has always been one of my favorites for that reason. It's nowhere near as complicated or as deep as Hummer or Mayonnaise or Soma that we're going to get to. But this one, just for its simple, you know, you have to put simplicity in context when you're talking about this band. But for its simplicity, I love it. And it's just it captures me that way.
Yeah, this is good. It certainly deserves to be a single off the album. Like it obviously it does. It probably fits the mold of what radio would want off of this album. It, probably because it wasn't 6 or 7 minutes. But the thing that I loved about it was the initial thing that attracted me to this song was the guitar sound. And that, because at the beginning, he's just kind of playing a couple, he's stringing together an open string and a couple of notes. And that opens, and that runs the theme throughout the entire song, even when the choruses are coming in. But it was so fuzzy and so distorted, it sounds like nothing I'd ever heard before. It was like, how did he get that effect to open this sound? And I thought this was really cool, again, from Billy's podcast where he talked about this particular sound. And he had Butch Vig on as a guest, I guess. And this is actually kind of funny now that they're still friends. But Butch Vig recorded Gish for the Pumpkins. Mm-hmm. And then went and recorded Nevermind from Nirvana. And Billy says that Butch stole Billy's guitar sound.
Yeah.
Gave it to Kurt Cobain to record Nevermind with. And Billy got mad about that. And he was like really pissed. So that when Butch came back to do Siamese Dream, Billy said, I want to play something entirely, entirely different sounding, and came up with all these different effects pedals and all this stuff, which then ended up kind of framing the sound of the entire album. But I think it's really neat because we've talked about this, or you and I have talked about this before. To the novice listener, most people kind of assume like they listen to after Jimmy left the band and then Adore came out and people say, oh, the Pumpkins totally changed their sound. And like even today, even or not the song today. I mean, like even in modern times, the majority of people out there are like, oh, I wish they would go back and and play songs that sound like their first three albums. I liked that sound the most. That's what a lot of people say. And Billy has addressed that. He's actually said, what people are missing, he said, the first three albums didn't sound the same. And he's like, why does everybody assume that, oh, I wish you would make songs that sound like your first three records. That was my favorite sound. He's like, they were totally different. Gish didn't sound anything like Siamese Dream. And the guitar sounds and effects in the songwriting for Melancholy was totally different than Siamese Dream. So it's really interesting that, you know, coming and this song kind of is indicative of my like take this the guitar sound of this song stands out to me as like that's something I'd never heard before. That is such an interesting guitar effect to lead off a song.
I that's something that a musician and especially a producer and Billy Corgan is a producer too.
Yeah,
I think it's easier for him to see the differences in those albums and their sound being so close to him and also like being of the world and like knowing that I think he could be a little bit more forgiving of the audience for asking for something that seems a little bit more common, a little bit more sort of like between those early albums. It's like, yeah, that kind of general sound.
Oh,
he might think they're vastly different, but to a general listening audience that doesn't have his, first of all, his experience writing the damn things and producing them himself, you know, it might be completely different. Yeah, that story about Butch Vig, I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to mention that. Like he has said that, you know, Butch Vig, who, you know, became the biggest producer in like overnight, like in the world with the success of Nirvana. But when he was producing Gish with them, he was kind of a nobody too. And Billy says that he taught Butch a lot of the tricks and a lot of the things that he's doing. And then Butch went and gave those same tricks to a different band that then skyrocketed and became the biggest thing. And Pumpkin, they were like, everybody was like, well, the Pumpkins, you've got to become the new Nirvana. And it's like, excuse me? Like imagine being told that. It's like, our guy just gave them all of our best stuff and now they're the tops and you want us to copy that? They took our stuff. Like, so yeah, like, and Billy has said, like, he never resented Kurt. He never resented Nirvana or any of those things.
Yeah.
Never about that, but he did feel a little bit jilted. Like, you sons of bitches, this should be our moment. This should be our success and our stardom. And when he did confront Butch about that, I think Butch, who could have ridden the success of Nirvana's Nevermind off on his own, he, like, to his credit, Butch was like, I know what you're saying, and I'm going to make it up to you. I'm going to make Siamese Dream as big as Nevermind. I'm going to help you do all this stuff. And he locked in. He passed up a lot of other offers to work with other people to help them record this sophomore album and make it everything that Billy wanted it to be, because he felt he owed him that debt. And that is probably what saved their relationship when it otherwise couldn't have. Yeah.
The last thing I want to say about the song Rocket, again, since we're on that, I think and I'm only bringing this up because you mentioned that this is probably the most traditional radio-friendly rock song structure-wise on the album. And I would agree with you there. I think it's funny, and I'm sure you've heard this argument before in some other interviews. I believe we've talked about this. But going into this album, after the success of Nevermind and 10, the record labels were saying, hey, why don't you write 3-minute pop songs with no guitar solos? Right. That's what they were telling them. And it's kind of funny because with the exception of maybe this song and maybe a little bit of Cherub Rock, you know, every other song on the album, Billy's response was, because we don't.
Yeah, it's like, that's not who we are.
Yep, we write 6-minute elaborate epic, you know, opuses and with lots of guitar solos. That's who we are.
Yeah, just before we go, my favorite part of the song, right at the end when we come out of the guitar solo, like when everything drops out and you just get that guitar. When we come out of there and the whole band kicks in together, to couple that with the symbolism of the name Rocket, it feels like a booster ignition that just we're taking off and we're flying somewhere. And that's the sensation I get for like the last minute of the song. I love that part.
Yeah. You know, real quick, and again, this is funny that I like exploring this stuff with you, because just to further showcase how abstract Billy's thought process is with the song, like after that guitar solo, when the music drops out and he goes back to an intro part, but it's not the same intro as the intro to the song. So it would have been very, very easy in traditional pop music songwriting sense. Like if you have a breakdown like that, you usually go back to the intro to the song, the guitar part to the intro, and it's different. And it's just like, Billy, what are you doing, dude? Like, why? You're making things unnecessarily hard for me trying to play the song.
All right. From there, and at this point, we are 5 tracks and about 24 minutes into the album or something close to that. And we have just been assaulted by just wave after wave of crashing guitars and drums and rock music, whether it's like jamming hard rock or psychedelic or wherever we go. We finally get this little reprieve and we turn it into the 6th song on the album, which is acoustic and instrumental strings driven. And this is, again, one of their bigger singles, the song Disarm. Mm-hmm. I could actually, I might actually make the distinction. Maybe this is actually the most traditionally structured song on the album. It just has a very different feel from Rocket, but in terms of like just more or less verse, chorus, verse arrangements, this one seems pretty kind of traditional. But yeah, it's this dramatic shift from the heavy guitar-driven rock songs. Now we have an acoustic guitar throughout the whole thing, and it is accented and chased by these orchestral strings. And yet is very just it's dark, it's hypnotic, it is cold almost, but it's still beautiful too. And this Billy has been very, very open about at different times. He has said that this is his very outward calling out his parents for his child abuse, and what he experienced going through. He's also said that this one is also fused with a lot of that same suicidal imagery that he had around the time when he wrote this with Today, when he said he wrote it that same night. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of suicidal thoughts and suicidal imagery in there that coupled with this idea of child abuse and neglect and kind of bodily harm. So what do you think about this one?
This song probably has the most that I could talk about. And I don't want to do an entire podcast just on this song, but there's a whole bunch of layers to this. You touched on it. You know, obviously this is the first time we kind of experience from Billy's perspective, the fact that he was an abused child and that, you know, we hadn't really experienced that in other songs so far. We didn't know what was making this guy crazy and want to kill himself and all this pressure. Now we understand that it was upbringing and stuff. And it's very indicting, you know, in this song, much like Today, you know, when those were written the same time where he decided to take control of his life rather than be a passenger. He's going to be the driver. And so he has talked about this was terrifying. Writing this song and putting it on an album, he thought was terrifying because it's a hit and it's great and it's beautiful and all those things you mentioned. But then, you know, he has to go home for Thanksgiving dinner and his family is there saying like, you know, what the fuck did you say about it and all this stuff. So again, it was a decision to live and not die. And that's kind of this song, much like Today, was therapeutic for him and helped him. But it's brutally honest in the lyrics in there. And he's even said there are certain things that I was not aware of on my initial listen. Lines like the killer in me is the killer in you. Mm-hmm. I wasn't aware until more recently that Billy said that stemmed from him having a dream about killing his parents. Mm-hmm. And that was something that, and he said, but then I'm continuing the cycle of abuse. And he said, I've just become them. And that type of thing. I'm like, oh my God, that's like, okay. Wow. There's a whole bunch of darkness in this song. Yeah. But putting it out there and venting it, you know, allowed him to live and break that cycle, so to speak. The only last thing I want to say about the sound, I think the recording of him and Butch Vig talking about the recording of this sound of this song, I think is fascinating. And not many people realize that this song was meant to be an electric song. It was meant to be a heavy electric song. And he has played it on various occasions. Remember that Vuforia VHS tape that we had?
Yeah.
There was a version of him playing this on like in England on the BBC or something, playing it as a heavy electric sound. For the most part, that's what they were trying to record. And for some reason, it wasn't working. And Butch kept saying, Billy, you know, something's not working. It doesn't sound different than the rest of the album. And they couldn't figure out what it was. They couldn't put their finger on it. And so Billy got really frustrated with Butch, came into the control booth with an acoustic guitar, grabbed it and said, this is what I want it to fucking sound like. And he starts strumming it, aggressively strumming an acoustic guitar. And Butch is like, oh my God, that's it. That's the missing piece. Let's get rid of the rest of the band. Like, you go in there and do this. And so then they record it. So then it becomes an acoustic piece and it's beautiful and it's gorgeous. Now they all of a sudden decide, okay, well, let's go with that. And Billy decides, I want strings. I want instrumentation. I want all this stuff. So they bring in two friends of the band, Eric Rimschneider and another guy who I can't remember the name of. But these two guys come in And again, the album's way over budget and they're way behind schedule. And so they've got like 6 hours to record the string parts to this song. So these two guys, accomplished classical musicians, come into the studio and Billy's like, okay, I need you guys to record violin and cello and blah, blah, blah for this stuff. And they're like, okay, where are our charts? And Billy's like, what are you talking about? And they're like, well, give us the music. We'll read the music and play it. And Billy goes, I don't know how to write music like that. So they're like, well, what do you want us to do? So in the span of the 6 hours, Billy then sings the cello part into a recorder, into a computer, what the cello line and what the violin line are. He sings it. And then the computer spits it out in musical format so these guys can actually do it. Now they've got like 2 hours left of these guys. So they each do their part, and I think there were maybe two cello parts and two violin parts are all they got out of it. And then those guys took off and left, and Butch Vig said, all right, well, let's double and triple it so it sounds like an orchestra. But and that's what you hear on the record. But there's honestly like one or two cello lines, one or two violin lines, and that's it. And then it's just multi-layered and layered and layered. And that's what you get out of it, because Billy didn't know how to write an orchestral score. So yeah. He was like, he was like, why aren't you guys understanding? Play this, play what I'm singing.
And it worked out so well that he's like, I'm going to start my next double album with.
Yes, we're going to do the same thing.
For tonight, yeah. Because the music is turned down with the acoustic and the strings, we're stepping away from the wall of sound guitars. Instead, we're putting the focus back on his vocals. And this is definitely one of his stronger vocal performances.
Very much so.
Especially when you get to the very end. Mm-hmm. So yeah, great, great one. So
wait, one more thing I want to point out, and this is just another example of Billy being Billy. So at the end of the song, I guess when they were recording the guitar part, Billy said it didn't feel like it had a resolve to the end. He just kept playing the chord for the chorus of the song is, I think, E major or E minor, D and C. And he just kept doing that over and over again, like the chorus. And he said the song didn't feel like it resolved itself. And he was like, you know, should we just do that and then fade it out or whatever? And Butch is like, I don't know. What do you want me to do? And Billy's like, well, what's it missing? And Butch goes, why don't you play those three chords backwards? So then at the end of the last chorus, it's D, C, E minor. He's just playing the same three chords in a different order. And they're like, that's it. That's what we're missing.
Oh, that's weird, but okay.
Yep.
Alrighty. So song 7, Soma. My favorite little Easter egg about this one is Mike Mills from REM guests on this one. And I think it's like they recorded this one in Triclops Studios in Georgia.
Yeah.
And REM is based out of Athens, Georgia. So maybe that was the connection there. But yeah, Mike Mills from REM plays piano on this track. And if you can hear the piano on this track, good for you.
Yep. I agree. I also thought it was funny too, because we know from future albums that Billy can play the piano.
Yeah.
So I found that weird.
Ooh, this one, this is another one of those little epic songs that takes you on a journey, because it starts off very quietly, you know, coming out of Disarm. This is kind of soothing and dreamy and atmospheric, as we're just getting like little guitar notes and high chords and everything. And it's a breakup song about getting dumped, and this idea of this loving relationship equated to a drug or an opiate that may be soothing and may put you to rest, and it keeps you sedated and calm. But it's not necessarily the truth of what's going on. And then halfway through, when we get to, you know, like 3 minutes and 31 seconds, this quiet, trippy ballad is just smashed over the head by this oncoming rush of the full band with the drums and the bass and just a fleet of guitars, like, mm-hmm. like an offensive amount of guitars on this song. the recording of it, and the final product I love to death. This is one of my favorites on the album. So what do you think about Soma?
Yeah, well, I don't, I mean, honestly, there's not a whole lot more I can add because all your notes are my notes. That's, I think, I did hear once Billy said something like they tracked 40 different guitar parts, overdub, sound effects for this song in the studio. And I guess there was Butch Vig did an interview once where he was asked about that. They're like, Billy said you did about 40 guitar parts for this. And he was like, no, not even close. He said, we probably did about 100. So I thought that was great. I think everything else that you said, I think, you know, in terms of lyrics, it's probably the most traditional on the album in terms of just having a straightforward kind of message. It's a breakup song, mm-hmm. and you get that. Yeah. And there's no beating around the bush. It's very concise and specific. I love the sound of this album, of this song. I love the placement on the album because it comes out of the one acoustic track on the album in the middle. And then this bridges the gap from starting quiet and then getting loud and going into more loud songs. Right. So I think it's interesting in the placement of it. It's a fantastic song. I mean, just talk about just being swaddled in this blanket of heavy guitars and sound. I mean, this is probably the most all-encompassing, you know, we've talked about this before, about there's these layers of music that Billy just wanted to create something ambitious. This mm-hmm. is as big as it gets. This mm-hmm. is just something like, it's just with headphones on, there is no ending to how much music is in this song. The only thing I would add that you didn't mention, which was, there were a certain occasions on the Siamese Dream tour where they would use this as the opener for the show. And on the surface, you might think, wow, what a bad song to open a concert with when you've got a loud, raucous crowd ready for you to come out and take the stage. And you open with 3 minutes of almost silence.
Yeah.
And I've seen videotapes of it, and it yet it still seems to work, and it shouldn't. So again, we keep coming back to this Billy Corgan, the contradictionist, you know, like things, you know, taking things that shouldn't work and making them work. That this song should never be an album, a concert opener. And it does, and it works. And then all of a sudden you go from that, like right after this, the second half of the song is bombastic and loud as it is. And then he might go right into like Quiet or Geek USA or something like that. And it's just like, okay, now the concert started.
Interesting little prologue for that concert. Yeah. I love this one so much. I love that, again, this idea, the first two choruses are completely different lyrics over the same choral melody.
Right.
But when he gets to the third chorus, he repeats both of the earlier choruses. He repeats the second chorus as the main lines. And then I think it's Darcy, or maybe it's him just doing it more in a more falsetto, is singing the first chorus as background vocals.
Yeah, underneath it.
Yeah, and like to couple both of those different choruses together for that last one is just, it's a masterful effect, and I love it. And just, ooh, yeah, just so good. So, yeah, awesome. Mm-hmm. And then coming out of there again, we've got another just fist-punching, like hard-hitting rock jam called Geek USA. A song about feeling alone, out of place, out of touch, this sort of social exile, full of self-doubt, full of self-hate, all these things that Billy is going through. After the second chorus, interesting, because the song quiets down. It has this remarkable change. Like we're doing the opposite of what Soma just did. Like this was an aggressive rock song, like Quiet was in the beginning of the album, but now we're stopping, like, and we're going trippy and dreamy. And these, he has the, you know, he talks about these Siamese twins at the wrist, and like, there's this contrasting Adam and Eve imagery, but also just like the, anytime you use the word wrist when you've got so much suicidal, mm-hmm. Like imagery and context in this album, just the word wrist itself kind of jumps out at you. And then it comes back with this bitchin' guitar solo that again is like one of those like all time greats. If you look at like those like music charts when they talk about guitar solos, and I've got more that I want to say, but I'll hand this off to you at this point. Like your thoughts on Geek USA.
Geek USA is a song that has grown on me over time. I think once I saw it live a number of times, I realized like this is so freaking intricate in terms of the, you know, just being a straightforward banger of a rock song. Like even a song like Quiet or even Cherub Rock are not as intricate in their structure as this is. This song has a lot of the elements that we've discussed in other songs, like a Hummer or something. There's a whole lot of different parts to Geek USA that never seem to return. Like, you know, the outro after the quiet breakdown you said, and then the guitar solo, then there's this whole other guitar riff that wasn't like in the previous choruses. And then all of a sudden the song slows down tempo and then ends for another 2 minutes like Hummer did on a completely other portion of the song that wasn't there before. Like, so there's this Frankenstein amalgamation of parts to this song that like, you're like, okay, where did all the, like, this could have been all these, were all these leftovers of another piece of music that he was like, I had no place for it. So I put it together and it became a song. It's got a sick energy to it that is just, yet like, this is one of those songs where even more so than Cherub Rock, which is, you know, universally acclaimed as like the best up-tempo song on the album, this is one of those songs where like if I'm on the treadmill at the gym and I'm just out of gas and I'm like, okay, I'm done, I'm ready to call it quits, and then this song comes on, nope, I'm running again, okay, here we go. You know, that's nope, here we go. So it yeah, everything you said about the lyrics, I have nothing else to add about it. It's very much, it's got, yeah, it's everything we've talked about, which is thematic of the entire album. There's a lot of apathy. There's a lot of self-hate. There's a lot of disillusionment, but they're done in very cryptic, beautiful poetry. He's got such a knack for, you know, writing the, like these images and making, like painting a picture with words, uh-huh. that, you know, even Kurt Cobain and Eddie Vedder weren't doing, you know, uh-huh. there's a completely different lyrical style. But yeah, that's about it. I mean, this song, it's just a banger. It's just an absolute banger.
And I think I want to jump on that because this comes back to this idea that I had before about this kind of difference between a pop songwriter and an alternative songwriter. And I mean, we kind of understand that a songwriter working in the sort of pop milieu is charged with capturing emotional experiences and sensations that are universal to all of us, and then translating them into a language that is equally universally clear and understood to make it as accessible as possible. So everybody knows. And, you know, like, yeah, we'll go through this.
That's beautiful.
And, yeah. And then Billy Corgan, and I think this was generally true of alternative rock music and songwriters of this generation, but I think Billy more than most eschews that practice. He transcribes these same universal experiences, but the language he uses is very unique and very personal to him. He makes the audience and the listener do the heavy lifting of deciphering what he means. And I think that was a much more potent idea in the early 90s, mm-hmm. Because the crowd he was speaking to, this Generation X crowd that felt very disaffected and maybe just kind of feeling tired of feeling like the world was talking down to them constantly. They're like, you know, if you give us, you know, don't talk to us like we're idiots. And maybe this idea of somebody just like, no, I'm using my own words, I'm using my thing. and the audience gets the reward of working harder and cracking the code of what he's talking to. And then they understand that, no, I do understand what he's going through. I've been through that too. And this is a common life experience, but he's not putting it in the simplest terms. He's putting it in complicated, deep, haunting, literary, poetic terms that are cryptic, but also revealing at the same time. And that's just kind of a joy if you can be on the inside of that and understand that. And I think that's why they captured the listener's attention at this particular time, that they were the right band for that generation.
Yeah, I think you phrased that phenomenally well. That was beautiful. I do agree with you, and I think there was, it's almost like once you crack the cheat code for reading Billy Corgan lyrics, then all of a sudden, like, now I get all of it. But like, you kind of have to sift, you kind of have to understand. It's like learning another language. It's like you have to have a different dictionary, and then once you learn his style of writing, then all of a sudden now I can go back in all his songs and see what he was talking about. You're right. It's not pop. And I can speak firsthand from, once upon a time, I was basically being mentored by the lead singer of the Turtles, Mark Volman, who wrote the song Happy Together.
Yeah.
I was being mentored by him and under his wing, and we were going over a lot of my demos and stuff. And at this point in my life, my songwriting had adopted and evolved very much of a Billy Corgan type of style. That's what we were listening to at the time exclusively. And so that filtered into the way I wrote and the way I put songs together. And I remember him very honestly telling me, this is not going to get on the radio. He was like, what you're writing, you're writing of a different time, of a different era. He said, to write a pop song, you got to write Roses Are Red, Violets Are Blue, and you've got to repeat that three different times in the song. And you have to get to your lyrics within the first 10 seconds and all this stuff. He was saying, what you're doing is fantastic, but it's of a different era. And what you said just kind of sums that up perfectly. It's like, yeah, there's a difference between writing a pop song and writing an alternative song. And I'm not saying one is better than the other. They're just completely independent of each other. It's a different style.
Right. Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on now, track 9, we finally get to Mayonnaise.
Shut my mouth and strike the demons, cursed you and your reasons. Out of hand and out of season, out of love and out of feeling. So bad, where I came.
Casual listeners of the band, people who know them from their singles, might say that, Today is their best song, or Bullet with Butterfly Wings, or Zero, or something. But the song that amongst Pumpkins fans and fanatics and diehards, the song that seems to have become the favorite Smashing Pumpkins song, which was never a single, is the song Mayonnaise. Lyrically, melodically, it kind of encapsulates everything great about this album and this era. And in a more recent time, Billy has kind of admitted that he was rushing to finish the song in the studio. Like, they had the music, but he didn't have the vocal tracks and he wasn't sure what to do. So again, he had this book of like different lines and different phrases and all these ideas. And he threw them all together in a kind of patchwork Frankenstein lyrics for this song. And in retrospect, looking back on it years later, he has identified that unbeknownst to him, there was kind of a through line in the lyrics of sensations and emotions that he was experiencing during the recording process with the rest of the band and how he felt at this time. And he thinks he has said that the song resonates with him more truthfully nowadays than it did at the time of its release. So what do you think about Mayonnaise?
Yeah. Well, what don't I think about Mayonnaise? this is, I mean, when we get to the rankings, this might not surprise anybody, but this is going to be up near the top of my list, if not the top, depending on how long it takes for us to get to that list, because it changes all the time. But but this boy, this is probably arguably the most beautiful heavy rock song I've ever heard. I don't know how else to explain it. It's for, I have heard the same stories that you just said about how the lyrics were kind of patchwork, and he was kind of putting together, like a lot of times artists in the studio will record a scratch vocal track, and it's just to kind of keep place and remember melody, and then they'll come back and rewrite the lyrics and go do a finer vocal take. And this sounds a lot like maybe they just kept the scratch vocal, the scratch lyrics at the beginning, but much like to Billy himself, you know, over time, this song has certainly lyrically resonated with me. And I think it's become an anthemic sort of lyric, especially the part that every fan wants to hear when they play this song live is the end, when he says, when he just calls out, I just want to be me.
Yeah.
And when I can, I'll try to understand. When I can, I will. That whole part in the octave that he gets to when he sings that, it's like the crescendo of everything good about this song. It's gorgeous. And it's gorgeous in and of the fact that the song is riddled with mistakes. And the most audible mistake that everybody talks about is this squealing guitar part, that this feedback that kicks in every time there's after a guitar strum, and then you muffle the strings and hold down to stop the music from playing, from the strings from ringing. There's a feedback kick in, yeah, from a guitar. And Billy said it was like a $65 pawn shop guitar that it never worked. It never, anytime the sound of the pickup was wired bad. And so it just constantly spit out feedback. You couldn't silence the guitar. So he wrote that part into the chorus and just left it. And it's an absolute mistake. And again, it goes back to what we keep saying over and over again, these things should not work. And yet it's a part of the song now. It's a part of the way we hear it in our head and in our heart. And so it's really neat. The last thing I want to point out, and then you can jump back into this, but mayonnaise as the title, first of all, doesn't mean anything. Second of all, it's spelled wrong. And this is a very, very interesting recurring theme with Billy Corgan and the Pumpkins. It's almost like they've got a whole lot of inside jokes that they don't reveal to the rest of the world. But they're known constantly for writing song titles that don't have a lyric in it, and then or purposely misspelling certain things. And case in point with the song Mayonnaise, somebody once had asked Billy, what does the song mean? What is the song title? Not even the spelling. They just said, what does the title Mayonnaise mean? And this was Billy's reaction. This is a quote from Billy Corgan. Say you write a song about a chandelier, and the chandelier gives off light, and the light seems to be the color red, and red reminds you of the color you're not supposed to wear around a bull. So you name the song Cow. Got it? So that's in Billy Corgan's head, that all makes perfect sense. So somehow, some way,
everybody clear?
Everybody got that? I just thought that was perfect, Billy Corgan. Like, okay, got it. Yep, got it.
Yeah, got it. And I don't know. I don't know where to go from that. But just like to think, like, it's a ballad. Mm-hmm. It is a ballad,
mm-hmm,
with more guitar and drum energy than like a Metallica song.
Yes,
it's
just, mm-hmm,
it's freaky. And my favorite part, like, I love it when it strips down to just the acoustic part,
yeah,
and this lull for the third verse,
mm-hmm,
and we get it, and it's just the soft acoustic guitar until the last two lines of that verse, and the drums,
mm-hmm,
pick up, and then,
yep,
we're back into the chorus and the whole band, the guitars and everything, and it's just that launching pad that leads into the crescendo. It's So good. And that will be reflective when we get to our rankings at the end.
Very much so.
And then we come to our second acoustic guitar song. And this one is called Space Boy. I think this, again, the arrangement of songs and the song order is very crucial to like the flow and how good this album is and how it resonates, because we have just had this, again, coming out of Disarm, we went with Soma, which starts and then just gets huge and huge, and then it's followed by this rocker Geek USA and then Mayonnaise, and we've had all of this big energy, big guitars. Okay, bring it down. We're now in this calming recession and coming acoustic guitar, just acoustic guitar after all that overwhelming sonic concussion. And this is a song written about Billy's brother and his feeling of the sense of connection, despite not having all of the disabilities that his brother had, the physical and mental disabilities, but the still sense of feeling like an outsider, a freak, disconnected and shunned by society, and writing this as a way of trying to connect that. When you put everything else on the back burner and just have Billy with the acoustic guitar, his vocals do come out front, and he is a much better, much more confident singer than I think maybe he even realized at the time, because this is another really strong vocal performance that I think is in this one.
I would agree with all of that, especially, you know, I think it was around, it was probably this song, because Disarm was obviously a hit. That was a single that was released. That was a hit. This song not being a single, but still being a straight acoustic track with just a little bit of keyboard at the end. I think this was probably the song that made me realize, okay, this band and more specifically Billy Corgan is a completely different type of writer than what I initially thought. Like, I think this opened up the door to me realizing there's a lot more depth and tenderness in balladry to what was arguably a gothic metal type of rock band, you know, kind of thing. And then as once all of a sudden the next B-sides album came out, we were exposed to, there's dozens of acoustic ballads and stuff like that. Like, there's, for every hard driving anthemic rock song he writes, he probably writes a tender acoustic ballad too. And, you know, we didn't get that from the other bands of their other peers. You know, Pearl Jam didn't seem to release that many acoustic albums. There was always one or two. Nirvana, maybe, you know, with the Unplugged, then we kind of got used to that. But it didn't seem like they were doing as much of the tender ballad type things. So, and then this was a precursor to what we would see on Melancholy and Infinite Sadness, which had maybe half of them were ballads and acoustic tracks and, or quiet tracks, I should say, not all mm-hmm. ballads, but quiet, right. You know, right. That kind of thing. And then Adore was a whole, you know, that. Mm-hmm. So I think this opened my mind to the fact that they weren't just this bombastic band. You know, there was a whole lot, like, this made me think like, wow, I could see like a whole acoustic, like an acoustic album of just Billy Corgan solo, and we would later, you know, be exposed to a lot more of this stuff. But this kind of brought that to me, because I don't think, you know, I don't think I felt that on Gish, and I don't think through most of this album, it's not like you got a sense of that. So yeah, this song's beautiful. It's pretty simple, and mm-hmm. I like it a lot. I don't have anything else more to say.
Looking at the album as a whole, I see it in kind of like these movements or these acts where mm-hmm. the first act is, you know, this just bombardment of heavy like rockers with Disarm as the closer of kind of like the first act, as we take a breath and we get this quiet, more acoustic song. And then Soma begins act two, and we got mm-hmm. again these great rock songs, and it's a different feel with a little bit more balladry, but still like the heavy guitars. And then this one is kind of this bridge between ending, closing act two, and then leading into the grand finale, which will be the track 11, and then It's not actually the last song. We'll keep going, but we'll talk about that. But this one feels like the culmination, the climax of the entire album.
I would agree with that.
Track 11, the nearly 9 minutes long Silver Fuck. This one is exciting. Again, hard-driving rock guitars, this machine-gun rapid but precise drumming by Jimmy. I can't say enough about that, but it's just, it's, again, this song, almost as a microcosm of the album itself, has multiple acts, these multiple movements. The first 3 minutes is essentially like an intro, a verse, and a chorus, and this guitar solo. And then we have another 3 minutes of trippy, dreamy verse, more poetic, like a little bit of a narrative. Guitars that are just kind of ambient noise, just like streaking across the strings, much more of like a kind of prog style. And then at almost 7 minutes, we come back with the heavy guitars, the rocking sound for another chorus, and then this really long outro. Where the song just kind of collapses in on itself. And this I looked up and I like this actually tracks with my own memory, but this of all things, despite its length, this is one of their most played live songs ever, because this was always the closer of the Siamese Dream tour. And then they changed the arrangement, but it was also the closer of the Melancholy tour. And then, or not the closer, but they would do it for the encores. Yep. And then they changed the arrangement of the song again during the Adore tour, but kept coming back to it.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think it's ironic that the album version tracks at almost 9 minutes, and that's the shortest version of the song you'll ever hear.
They've done a live version that is over half an hour.
Yes, they have. 35 minutes, where he actually told, you know, he basically warned the audience, like, all the fair weather fans can go ahead and leave now. Head to the parking lot. This song, it's exciting. I think you use a perfect adjective. I think that's great. It is exciting. It's got the traditional pumpkin chord that I keep talking about. I love that chord, the octave, that's the octave of D in that. And it's just this showcases Jimmy. It showcases Billy. It showcases, I mean, in live versions, it showcases every aspect of the band, because there's a part where it's the musical breakdown is the bass and drum. So the bass player has to have their, be warmed up and ready to go. My thing with this song is I have a hard time separating the multiple live versions I've heard from the album version of the song, because I've heard this probably done a dozen times. I mean, I've probably heard versions of this song done live with different arrangements more so than you even have, because they kind of always, they change it up on almost every tour and play it at some point. What's interesting is over the course of live versions of the song, most notably during the Melancholy tour, Billy elaborates on the lyrical theme of the breakup, and he gets darker and more introspective and personal about this being about his divorce. And his first marriage to Chris Fabian, they ended up getting together and breaking up and getting together and breaking up and then getting married and then getting divorced and all this stuff. This song is, you know, it's notably about her, but over the course of the years, Billy, their lyrics have changed in this song and gotten much more darker and much more like angsty and hatred filled and seething and dark and stuff like that. So it goes off on another tangent, and then the aggressiveness and the excitement of the music kind of makes sense when you realize, no, it's really an angry song. it's really there. But I don't even know where else to go with it other than this song just it just rips. And it doesn't surprise me at all that this is usually the concert closer and probably the most played song live. It makes perfect sense to me.
I think if Siamese Dream was a perfect album, I think this could be the closer. Mm-hmm. I think they could have ended it here at 58 minutes, approximately 11 yeah. tracks, and they could have ended here. They don't. They keep going for two more songs, which I think is the difference between a perfect album and a no-skip album.
Yep.
Because as we continue, we get to track 12, Sweet Sweet. So, like, I mean, like, I wanted to put the caveat, like, that, like, if I was cheating, if I was listening to this album digitally, maybe I would skip this track. But it's also the song is only a minute and a half long.
Right. So that's the thing.
It's almost hardly worth it. That's why you just stick with it. I'm already an hour into this album. Like, what's one more minute going to kill me?
Yeah. No, I agree with you. When I listen to it, it feels kind of like a throwaway or like an interlude. Like, you know, lots of albums of the 90s had that kind of thing where they're even on hip hop. And stuff, there'd be like a minute long interlude of something else, but you know, it's not a skip for me. Right. You know, it's beautiful and interesting and dynamically different than a lot of the album, and yeah, it's
well crafted, it's melodic, but my feeling more than anything is it feels a little bit out of place.
Yeah,
and not the way it comes after Silver Fuck, but the musicality of it, the way it was recorded, to me, it feels like a preview of what we'll get from some of the songs on Melancholy.
Yeah.
He might have been writing this song too early in the band's career, because this song feels like it could have been on Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness.
Yeah, or simply left off for until Pisces. It could have been on the B-sides album, because it mirrors with a lot of like Were or Soothe you know, some of that stuff.
I don't have much more else. It's more or less a throwaway, except we don't skip it on a no-skip album or podcast.
That's true. That would ruin the title.
All right, so we do move on to the last track, track 13, Luna. With everything that I just said with Silver Fuck feels like the perfect closer, I have no problem with the song. I like this song a lot, actually. I think this is a beautiful closer. To me, it feels like if Silver Fuck was the end of the movie, this is the song you play during the ending credits.
Yeah, fair.
This is just kind of like, this is the epilogue.
I like
this
that.
This is the song you play as you're leaving the theater, as you're leaving a concert. It's just, but it also, if I could be fair, to me, this feels musically a little bit more like a throwback to Gish.
Yes, it is.
A little bit more than what feels like it. It feels more like a Gish song to me than a Siamese Dream song. It has more of that psychedelic, the sitar sound. I don't know.
Well, it's got hints of a lot of the Eastern musicality that that Billy used on that kind of sprinkled throughout Gish. This has that too. Yeah.
So that kind of that reminds it. I do think it is a nice closer. It's a great kind of reprieve from Silver Fuck, as I was saying. It feels like a chance to catch our breath before we go. I've heard contrasting stories that this was written for an ex-girlfriend. Billy maybe denies that. Yeah, I've seen one interview where he said, cryptically, of course, as he does, that this song was written for the moon. that's why it's called Luna. And maybe if you parse that a little bit, the code, like, it's written for some unattainable love, some conceptual love that you can never actually reach. That's not really the truth. It's just that's not the person that you're actually with. It's a pretty song. It's actually pretty close to like the middle of my list of favorites. Even with this weird kind of psychedelic sounding, but it's I have no problem. I like this as a closer.
Yeah.
Would the album as a whole be greater if it ended on Silver Fuck? Maybe. Hard to judge, but this is still a really pretty song, and I'm glad to hear it every time.
Yeah, me too. It's a fun song to actually play and strum the guitar to. It's an interesting tuning. It's non-traditional D, but it's an interesting tuning. It's fun to play, and it's kind of beautiful. Like you said, it's soft and beautiful, and coming after. It does feel much like an epilogue. I like the way you phrased that, and I think that's better than I would have tried to, as I tried to explain where this falls in the movie of this album. I think you summed that up perfectly. This would be like as you're walking out during the credits, like this would be what you hear. I like that. In terms of the lyrics, I think it's really funny that you brought up different stories, contrasting stories about the lyric, because Billy himself has contrasted his own story about this. And this, surprisingly, in that 33 podcast that I talked about before, he had a guest, Sierra Swan, who he's worked with before as a guest on the show. And this, or maybe it wasn't her, maybe it was somebody else. Forgive me if I got the name wrong, but there was a female guest on, and this song they chose to spotlight and talk a little bit about, and they were kind of guessing who the song's about. And they had talked about, you know, one of the things that had the ideas had been floated. They were like, well, the song, is this like you looking in a mirror? Is this a song about self-love? Are you singing it to yourself? Like to be in love with yourself, and, you know, or was it about God or something? And then there, because the girl who was the guest said, there's one point at the end of the chorus and at the end where for only one time through the song, he says, I'm in love with you and you. And she says, what does that mean? Is that now, are we talking about a threesome? Like what? She was like, I don't, that's the only time you say it. But now this makes me think, is it the Holy God, the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit? Is it, you know, like all this other stuff? And Billy's response was something like, why does it have to be about anybody? And that's kind of how he ended it. And they were like, okay, moving on. So we don't know. We don't know what this song is about, but we can guess that it was probably written around the end of the Gish sessions or after, in the aftermath of Gish, when they were still heavily doing acid and listening to Ravi Shankar's sitar and Eastern modalities and stuff. It sounds very much like a Gish track, and I agree with you there.
Yeah. And that's it. That is the end of Siamese Dream. He's a top five favorite album for me, pretty easily. Not quite perfect, but about as close as you can go for an album that is over an hour long with 13 tracks. Just ambitious as hell. Succeeds on just about every level. The optimal one being not a song that I would skip, which is the whole point of this. I challenged you when we were going to do a little thing about either putting the songs, our favorites or ranking them. I actually did rank all 13. But again, like the top four would all frequently change. I'll go first and then I'll ask you for your favorites, and you can either do like a top five or the whole thing. I would put Sweet Sweet at the bottom, at number 13. Again, nothing wrong with the song. Just its placement of where it begins. Number 12. It's Today, honestly. It's a great song. It's a popular song, but maybe just for my taste, like a little bit overexposed and overdone. 11, and I know we'll disagree with this one, but 11 for me is Quiet. And that is not to be a knock on the song, because I like the song. It's just, it doesn't hit me the same way. Number 10, Luna. Number 9, Space Boy. Number 8, Geek USA. Number 7, Silver Fuck. Number 6, Disarm. 5 is Cherub Rock. And then the top four, again, these are so interchangeable. Ask me in an hour and I might be different. But for now, I'll say number four is, I'm going to say Rocket after our discussion, even though yesterday when I wrote my notes, I had Rocket at number one. But now I'm going to have Rocket at number four. Number three is Hummer. Number two is Mayonnaise. And number one today is Soma.
Interesting. Wow, that's cool. Okay, I can't argue with that list, and the reason is because my list changes all the time. Like, it's one of those, this is one of those albums where when the next song comes on, I'm like, oh, this is my favorite song. Yeah. And then the next song comes on, I'm like, oh, no, this is my favorite song. This has that. I'm not going to go through all 13 because the bottom half is very, very similar to yours, with albeit with a few exceptions. My top five, as of the recording of this moment, would be, believe it or not, number five would be Disarm. Number four would be Cherub Rock.
Okay.
Number three is Geek USA.
Okay.
And I mentioned that specifically because, as I mentioned when we talked about that song, this song has grown on me over mm-hmm. time. If you were to ask me a year ago, Soma would have been in my top five. It's, you know, and it's weird. Like, when you're ranking greatness, you know, at some point something's got to fall off the top five, and it doesn't mean it did anything wrong. And as of this moment, I'm going to go number two, Hummer, and number one, Mayonnaise. But yeah. Unlike yours, your top four changes a lot. My top two change a lot. Mm. I'll go back and forth where Hummer is my favorite song on the album.
It has been in the past. It has been for me too. So.
Yeah. Now, the only thing I want to add that we haven't touched on at all, really quick before we go, is let's reference some of the notable B-sides that were recorded for this album and left Ooh. Off.
Yeah. Oh, man, we could do a whole thing on Pisces Iscariot then.
I know we could. But specifically, and if anybody's familiar with those, any of the B-sides, my two that jump out at me, and there's a lot. That album is a standalone great album. But Frail and Bedazzled and Hello Kitty Cat, both of them sonically fit this album really well.
Yeah.
They could seamlessly plug in holes on this album. And it's a no skip album, but it's not perfect. And, you know, there are times where I make a playlist and I swap out maybe the last two and then plug those two in. And then all of a sudden this is, dare I say, almost a perfect album. So, and there's plenty of B-sides. Whir is one of my favorite acoustic tracks ever by the Pumpkins, mm-hmm. and that was left off this. So what do you think? What are some of the B-sides that you think about?
Was Starla written for this one, or was it for
no,
Gish?
No, Starla was for Gish.
Okay, shit. I was going to say Starla and Hello Kitty Cat, I would actually put above any song on this album. Yeah. But
Actually, I stand corrected. Hold on, really quick. Starla was recorded after Gish. But not for this album.
Not part of these sessions.
Yeah, okay. because the sound of Starla, the sonics of Starla sound more like Siamese Dream than
yeah. That's what I was thinking. Yeah. Yeah, Starla's one of my favorite. I mean, Hello Kitty Cat. If that was on this album, that might be my favorite song of the album. And again, I've just always loved that. And again, talk about being just bulldozed by Jimmy's drums. And it's
yes.
like, how can you play that fast? Like, how? Like, if you're on heroin, like, that's the wrong drum to be taking.
Yeah.
The wrong
drum. Oh my God. Yeah.
If you're
I know.
The drums, like, you need like an eight ball for that song. Like, what are you doing? Man? Maybe he needed the heroin to come down after playing the drums.
Maybe.
Like, just that's.
Well, think about this for a second. Let me just tease your brain for a second. Based on your rankings that you just told me, imagine Hello Kitty Cat in the two spot instead of Quiet.
I'm going to be sad now. Now I'm living in a life of what if. Okay. Again, that's just some incredible song that did not make the list. And that's one of those things. Like, if I'm talking about my favorite Pumpkins albums, it's like, well, does Pisces Iscariot count as an album? Because it's just a compilation of outtakes. It's like, it's not a studio album. It's like, but they're studio recorded tracks. So Yeah, I don't know. That's a tough one, but
It really is. It really is tough. And
but
it,
it
just
also
kinda...
it's also like, but it doesn't just feel like they just threw a bunch of songs on it. Like that album in itself has this like Frankenstein quality of being all of these different things that don't belong, but gel just the way they do.
Yeah, yeah. There's a weird cohesion to it that it does. It ebbs and flows, but feels like it takes you on a ride, like an album, like a concept album does.
Right, and it feels like a good. It feels like a perfect grace note for Gish and Siamese Dream,
mm-hmm.
because certainly by the time they get to Melancholy, we're in a different phase of the Smashing Pumpkins.
Yeah.
But yeah, folks, listeners, that was Siamese Dream from start to finish. Our thoughts on the album. What did you think about the album when you heard it? If you've heard it, I hope you do now. Yeah, I hope you've taken this journey with us. What did you think about our coverage of it? Please leave us some feedback either on some form of social media or in the comments section. We'll get back to that. Also feel free to share with us some of your favorite no skip albums or perfect albums. Where do you draw the distinction? No promises, but if you mention something that's good, then a chance we'll talk about it on a future episode. Any final outgoing thoughts before we close this one out?
No, nothing else other than I'm really excited about this new format that we're going to try and experiment with multiple albums coming up. I think we were able to still kind of focus on the artists that we want to discuss, but talk about the craftsmanship of putting together an album and what, like, that's, you know, song selection and recording and all that stuff and what gets put on and what gets put where and what gets left off. That's a fascinating rabbit hole to go down anyway. So I'm really excited about doing this. Obviously, this is one of the most impactful albums of our lives on a personal level. But I hope that we explained why to people out there. And I'm very curious to hear people's feedback. And for, you know, if somebody likes this album, but I'm curious to know what your rankings are. Maybe theirs are completely flipped from ours. You know, I'm curious. I love the discussion.
For the next episode, as I said, we're not pivoting completely because the next episode we're going to go back to covering up another artist. If we can get it done before Thanksgiving, I without telling you who we're covering, I'll just tell you it might be bigger than the last cover songs episodes that we've done. I don't know if we can get the next episode done in under 5 hours, but we'll find out. So, Fire and Water Records is a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Feedback for the show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com as well as the Facebook page for Fire and Water Records.
Special thanks to our Patreon supporters. For information on how you can support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, visit patreon.com/FWpodcasts.
All music clips and quoted lyrics are used for entertainment purposes. Please support the artists and their work by purchasing or downloading the songs legally.
Thanks for listening, and happy Halloween.
Ooh.